I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On August 18th, 1920, American women got the right to vote with the passage of the 19th Amendment, and today more women use that right than men. Our guest Angela Dodson has written about that hard-fought battle in her new book, Remember the Ladies. The title is something that Abigail Adams famously said to her husband when he joined members of the Continental Congress to write this new nation's laws. Dodson tells us about the women, many of whom were abolitionists, who lobbied and protested and argued and finally persuaded the country to support women's suffrage. Angela Dodson is contributing editor for Diverse Issues in Higher Education. She served as senior editor, I should say, for the New York Times and executive editor of Black Issues Book Review. And she's speaking and signing books tonight at the South Jazz Parlor, 600 North Broad Street in Philadelphia, starting at 5:30. And Angela Dodson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So why don't we know more about this history, more about this women? You are a book person, and you admit at the very beginning of this book that some of this, a lot of this, was really a revelation to you.
It was. There are a few books on this topic as a whole. There are lots of books maybe on individual women, but very little that puts it all together, and some of the major textbooks are old now. But there's no other book that really gives a comprehensive look from the beginnings of the movement, and even before there was a movement, how few rights women had and what the conditions were for women in America up through the last election.
But it does beg the question, why? I mean, this is such important history.
Right. Well, this history is not taught in schools. As I say, I got from grade school to grad school from the 50s to the 70s without learning any of it. Even though, you know, I'm a history buff, so I've never come across a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I took major history courses in grad school. We don't have many books. We don't have many teachers. We don't think about it. It's kind of like Black history, only I found for women's history, it's just about worse. So,
yeah. Well, hence the corrective here exactly. That I'm holding in my hands. Let me quote. It's always fun to quote Abigail Adams, taking the title of your book, Remember the Ladies. She says, "Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Now, she wrote that in 1776. It took about 150 years to actually get that right to vote. But
right.
Strong words coming from Abigail Adams.
Yes, they were. Her husband at the time was on his way or had arrived, I guess, at the Second Continental Congress here in Philadelphia. And she was a more educated woman than most people at the time, even though she wasn't formally educated. And she and her husband had a more equal relationship than most people did. So, you know, coming from her, it makes it very, very important. Now, the interesting thing is that the historians say she didn't really have the vote in mind at that point.
I was wondering about
but
that.
It's, you know, women had so few rights. It was things like property rights and the right to divorce or have custody of your children or whatever. And as it turns out, the Second Continental Congress didn't really write any laws. They just kind of did the Declaration of Independence and went off to run the war. And it was still a loose confederation of colonies even after the war until the Constitution was written, you know, years later.
Interesting. There's some interesting little side notes here. One was that New Jersey, this is 1797, New Jersey recognized the right of women to vote.
Actually, in 1776, the Continental Congress asked the states to go ahead and write their constitutions. And New Jersey was one of the first, and it was the only one that gave women the right to vote in that first constitution. And it even reinforced it in a couple of other laws later. But by 1807, it had reneged and took the vote away from women and consequently also from black men. So, you know, women in New Jersey didn't have the vote again until 1920.
It's interesting to trace, I guess, the very beginning of the suffrage movement, right. Which really starts before the Civil War. Is there a moment, you think, or perhaps a person that took this on that marks the beginning of this battle?
Well, Lucretia Mott, who was a famous Quaker preacher, in fact, one of her biographers says she was the most famous woman in America at the time, always dated the movement from the creation of anti-slavery societies in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society, which was interracial. And those women began meeting in the late 1830s. And there were a couple of national conventions. In fact, on my way here to your station, I noticed there's a historical marker next door that marks Philadelphia Hall. That was where one of the meetings took place, and it was burned to the ground because black women were present, and I think black men as well. So this was an important starting point. But the other important point that most people mark the movement from was the Seneca Falls Convention in New York in 1848, which happened because Lucretia Mott was present. She was visiting the area and went to basically a tea party with some other nice Quaker ladies and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was not Quaker, but she was married to one of the most famous abolitionists at the time. They decided that, you know, the state of women's rights was horrible and they should do something. And they called a meeting. And within less than 2 weeks, they had called the meeting, advertised the meeting, wrote the resolutions, wrote the sentiments. And 300 people showed up on horseback, by buggy, whatever, you know, to that meeting. And Seneca Falls then was more of a boom town than it is now. But it would have been a very, very important event.
It sort of makes sense when you think about it that the abolitionist movement, maybe even the temperance movement and women's suffrage were, in a sense, part of the same cloth.
Yes. I make the point in the book that almost all of the originators were abolitionist. But my book ties together all of these movements and what they were doing and how they were supporting each other at the same time. These same women who called the Seneca Falls Convention were also fairly active on the Underground Railroad and fairly open about it. One of them, Martha Wright, writes about having entertained a runaway man in her kitchen and talked to him the morning after. Elizabeth Cady Stanton talks about meeting a mulatto girl in the attic of her cousin who had his house was a station in upstate New York. And Susan B. Anthony writes about outfitting a family to go away. So they were really active. These were some of the most radical abolitionists in the country, and they were known stations on the Underground Railroad. You mentioned the temperance movement also is important in here because people like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton got their start in the temperance movement. And temperance was a women's issue because one thing I didn't know is that people back then drank a whole lot more than they do now.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
And they got their pay in liquor, some of them. And if women had no rights, a drunken husband was a huge problem. You couldn't get away from him, and if you did, you couldn't get your children away from him. And he couldn't support you. Few women had any income of their own or supported themselves. They didn't even have the right to the house that they were in, even if their father gave it to them. So liquor was a big issue for a lot of people at the time, and it was certainly a plank in the women's rights movement.
It's interesting that the 14th Amendment, which gave enslaved men, this was 1868, gave enslaved men the right to vote, predated the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote.
Yes. And that, you know, that caused a big split in the women's movement. There were supporters who had been totally for the 13th Amendment. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony ran a major campaign and formed an organization to support the 13th Amendment to make sure that the enslaved people remained free even after the war, no matter what the Emancipation Proclamation said. It could have been undone. But after the war, people like Frederick Douglass, who'd been active since Seneca Falls, which I didn't mention his presence there, wanted to support the 14th and the 15th Amendment, which kind of solidified black men's rights. The other people did not want to support black men's rights if women's rights were not going to be on the table at the same time. They wanted women's suffrage and black male suffrage. So there was a major split, and two organizations form. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony go off and form one. A woman named Lucy Stone formed another one. And black women attended both, and some black men attended both. But That split remained for like 20 years, and it probably was a major factor in the delay in getting the vote for women.
Which happened eventually, finally, in 1920. It seems, again, in hindsight, that this was inevitable. At some point women were going to get the right to vote in this country. Right. But was there something unique about that time that this heralded in women's suffrage?
About 1920?
Yes.
Well, for one, I mentioned the two organizations had gotten back together. So there was one strong national association for women's suffrage. Other people had gotten behind them. A lot of wealthy socialites were funding them, for one. And men were not just getting involved. Men had always been involved in the women's rights movement. But more men were there. Opposition to the women's right to vote was softening in some places. The political machine in New York, Tammany Hall, for instance, dropped its opposition because they figured that their women would vote like they did, I guess. So there were a number of and even more important is that there was a radical faction of the women's suffrage movement led by Alice Paul, who's right here from this area in South Jersey, who was also Quaker. The Quaker women always were important in this movement, but this is like two different periods where the Quaker person came to lead. And it was because they believed in their own rights, for one. They believed in a fair amount of equality for everybody. But she took her cues from the British movement, which had always been more militant, more violent, and applied some of those tactics to the American movement. And so they were able to do like a good cop, bad cop thing, good girl, bad girl. The major association towed the line kind of on more traditional things, although they also took place in the parades and stepped up their game in terms of outdoor displays of women's power. And Alice Paul's people went to jail, got beaten, did all kinds of other things that brought attention to the movement.
Sure, sure. Well, we're almost out of time here. And it's interesting, just zeroing up to today, is that more women vote than men.
Yes.
They don't all vote the same, obviously.
Right.
But use that suffrage.
Yes. One of the opposition to women's suffrage was that they thought women would vote as a bloc. And as it turned out, they didn't. Women had different interests from each other, one another. But they have used the power of the vote more than men since about 1980. Wow. Women have voted in larger numbers, and that hasn't always worked out. In this last election, 53% of them voted against the woman, and 53% of white women, I should say. 96% of black women did vote for her. And that's, setting aside race, everything in terms of women's interest, I guess.
Well, Angela Dotson, thank you for stopping by and joining us today in Radio Times, talking about your new book called Remember the Ladies. And you can catch up with our guest. She's speaking and signing books at the South Jazz Parlor. That's on 600 North Broad Street in Philadelphia, beginning at 5:30. Again, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll be talking about Amazon and dating after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Amazon is looking for a city of at least 1 million people with good transportation, an educated workforce, a stable business-friendly environment, a location that would attract and keep strong technical talent, a community that thinks big and has real estate options. In return, Amazon said this new site could mean more than 40,000 new jobs and an investment of $5 billion for construction costs and operations of a new headquarters. Since its announcement in early September, cities in the United States, even in Canada, are competing with each other, hoping to be chosen by Amazon for HQ2. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney tweeted, "We think Philadelphia would be prime," in capital letters there, "prime location for Amazon that would make people smile," in capital letters, looking forward to submitting a proposal. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. And joining us is Adam Ozimek. He is a senior economist at Moody's Analytics, where he covers the Pennsylvania economy as well as labor markets and demographics. Adam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Are you there, Adam?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. A little pregnant pause there. Will Bunch is sitting across from me here in our Philadelphia studio. He writes the Attitude column for the Philadelphia Daily News. And Will, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, we want to know where you stand on this giant proposal here. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Adam, let me begin with you. How unusual is it for a company, especially a company of this size, to have a competition to locate its headquarters?
I've never seen it done before. Usually this is kind of behind the scenes negotiation going on, and the company will approach a few cities and negotiate a deal behind closed doors, and then it becomes public, and sometimes the details of the deal are debated after the fact. But to put out a proposal that says basically, hey, we're looking at all comers, what's the best deal you can give us? That's pretty unusual.
Well, good for Amazon, I'm assuming. Does it put them in more in the driver's seat than any city that would be chosen?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it's not totally out of the city's hands, of course. I mean, Amazon can't go anywhere. If you look across the country at the kinds of places that could accommodate Amazon, that have the things that Amazon wants, it's not like they have, they can go anywhere. There are a lot of places where there isn't the population base to support it. And if you look at the list of the things Amazon wants, they want public transportation, they want a major airport, they want to be near highways, they want a city of a million or more. It's not all 3,000 U.S. counties bargaining against each other. It's really more like a handful of big cities. So Amazon does have some power here, but it's not unlimited.
I'll get back to some of that. Will, let me get you in on the conversation.
Sure.
You began your piece, I'm not sure how to put this exactly, saying that if Amazon set up its headquarters in Philadelphia, the geeks would arrive and people's sex life would go down. Let's just put it that way. I know that
you're paraphrasing.
I'm paraphrasing. I know that's a bit of
that.
A joke on your part.
Yeah.
But tell us why you began with that, I will say, stereotype.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked me about why I wrote, Will's crazy Tinder and Amazon piece. And the reason I started the story that way, it's not because I think Amazon's impact on Philadelphia's sex life, for want of a better term, is the most important aspect of this. It's far from the most important aspect of this. But what I started that way because I want people to think that about the law of unintended consequences of being careful what you wish for. I mean, when you were talking a moment ago about Amazon, few companies do it this way, but this has been fantastic PR for Amazon because this is a company that's very controversial. A month ago, people were writing, oh, I'm really worried Amazon is destroying the supermarket industry by buying Whole Foods. Jeff Bezos can be a union buster. He's doing some weird stuff at the Washington Post. A lot of negative publicity. Now, every city in the country is going around talking about how much they love Amazon and what a great company this is. And I mean, I've never seen a PR windfall here. And I want people to think more broadly about what Amazon means. Also, what I wrote, I think, was misinterpreted by a few people that I was arguing that Amazon should not come here. That's not exactly what I was arguing.
No, if you read the whole thing, you're saying these are some things you should think about.
Well, 2 points. There's things you should think about. And I think Philadelphia should make a big play for Amazon. I think we're a remarkable fit for them. But I think we should think way outside the box. I mean, I think what Amazon wants is a deal. And I think what Philadelphia should say is, look, we're the right city for you, but we're not offering you a deal. We're offering you a partnership. We want you here. We're perfect for you, but we need your help in housing, schools, other areas.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Adam. Is that the kind of deal that a company like Amazon would take, and what Will's piece was about, which is to say Philadelphia has a lot to offer, but it also has some problems. If you're going to come here, we need your help in dealing with improving the schools and addressing the difficult housing and poverty problem. Is that a selling point, you think, to a place like Amazon?
No, I don't think so. I think if you go to Amazon and say, hey, not only are you can you come here and bring us these high-paying jobs and all the important positive spillovers that come with that, but we're also going to demand all these special favors for you, and we're going to put all these extra restrictions on you. I mean, Philadelphia already has a bad reputation when it comes to the ease of doing business in the city. And for Philadelphia to come out the gate and say, you know, not only are we putting these the usual extra restrictions that we put on businesses, you know, the recent law to ban the use of past salary information is one example, but we're going to ask for some specific Amazon-only constraints and extra handouts. I think that's going in the wrong direction. I think, you know, I agree on thinking about unintended consequences, but I think that Philadelphia is dealing with the long-running repercussions of the unintended consequences of not being as business friendly as they should be.
Well, I think we all can agree about the wage tax that we all pay. And I'm assuming, Adam, and to you, Will, as well, that when Philadelphia is competing, that's got to be a bit of a black mark against the city, the fact that we pay such a high wage tax, even as the city is incrementally bringing it down.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, on the morning that this was announced and I was looking at the criteria and I saw public transportation, a highly educated workforce, I'm thinking, oh, my God, they're describing Philadelphia. And then I got to a line where they said tax structure. And that just like that kind of stopped me cold because, you know, and, you know, Jeff Bezos is supposed to be a libertarian. I can't imagine he would be a huge fan of the Philadelphia wage tax. And there's other tax. There's the business privilege tax, which is, I understand it, and I'm not an expert in economics, but is could be particularly onerous for a company like Amazon, depending on how that's applied to them. That's going to be that's going to be one of the things that's going to have to be worked out.
Adam, you want to weigh in on that, how you see that? I mean, obviously the city needs money, and that's how they use their taxes. But nonetheless, is this something that's going to put Philadelphia second place?
I'm not sure who the lead contenders are quite yet. And I mean, Philadelphia obviously has strengths and weaknesses. And the business taxes and the wage tax are, I think, pretty negative marks against Philadelphia. And so, you know, that's a really important reason to not, you know, add on extra baggage to the city and demanding that Amazon has got to help bail out its schools directly, in addition to the indirect ways that they'll benefit the schools. So, the wage tax is on its way down, and that's good. And I think that there's a lot of discussions about reform. And in a sense, Amazon's, you know, they would be getting here, while that conversation's happening, and hopefully this can help, you know, focus the conversation on that. In terms of whether Philadelphia can really win Amazon with the wage tax there, in my piece, I took a close look at Philadelphia and the pros and cons, but we haven't weighed all the cities and their pros and cons. That's something at Moody's Analytics that we're actually working on, putting together a big data-driven ranking of the cities. So we'll see when that's done where Amazon lands.
Well, the New York Times did their version of that. They ended up in Denver, Colorado. I'm agnostic on all this stuff, but
I don't think Denver. I think Amazon wants to be on the East Coast. I think they want to be on the Eastern Seaboard and in the heart of the action. And you know, there's been a lot of talk about Boston and D.C. Bloomberg did a piece saying identifying Boston as a front runner. I don't think either of those cities have the room to accommodate something like Amazon. I know, you know, Bezos bought the Washington Post. He bought a $23 million mansion in D.C. Baltimore is an intriguing – it's near D.C. and it does have the capacity to grow. Obviously, it has a lot of the same – problems and pathologies that Philadelphia has. So, but I think Philadelphia, again, I think, you know, I think when you look at the host of factors, the taxes is a downer, but I think we have a lot of real positives.
That is Will Bunch. He writes the Attitude column for the Philadelphia Daily News here with us in our Philadelphia studio. Adam Osamek joining us by telephone. He's a senior economist at Moody's Analytics, and he covers the Pennsylvania economy as well as labor markets and demographics. And we are talking about the kind of dating game that's going on. Amazon looking for a city for its second headquarters and offering some goodies, including more than 40,000 new jobs. Interesting, something we should talk about. And obviously a huge investment in construction costs and certainly for the operations of a new headquarters. And we want to know what you think. 1-888-477-9499. You want Amazon here in the Delaware Valley? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Adam, let's say that Philadelphia is chosen. Are there 50,000 people or 40 to 50,000 people here who could fit the job skills that Amazon is looking for?
I mean, they're not here tomorrow. Amazon couldn't open up a 50,000-person office tomorrow and find all those people putting their resumes out. They could find a lot of them, and the 50,000 number is really expected over a relatively long period of time. So they don't need to come up with 50,000 workers tomorrow. It's going to be a couple thousand to start, and Philadelphia can accommodate that. I mean, one of the mistakes that the New York Times made in their ranking was they focused on 10-year job growth. And if you go back 10 years, Philadelphia doesn't look so great, but the last 5 years, really the last four or 3 years, the city has really taken off in a job growth boom. And so I think, you know, Will's right about the capacity. There's room to grow here. There's a lot of space. There's a lot of land. And there's also that near-term momentum that we are growing over the last few years. And there is this momentum in the right direction. So I think, you know, if things continue, then the people are moving here. People are coming here. There's going to be labor supply.
Well, one of the concerns you had, and obviously we want good paying jobs. I mean, that's an important role to play in a city like Philadelphia, but that could drive up the cost of living. I mean, we are, compared to certainly New York and Washington, D.C., Boston, a more affordable place to live. If Amazon were to headquarter here, would that drive up that cost of living?
Oh, absolutely.
And you perhaps know, drive out other people.
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest people read a really good story that's on Philly.com and in the Inquirer and Daily News this morning about exactly that issue. Seattle now, I mean, I was kind of shocked to read this. Seattle is now the ninth most expensive city to live in the world, not just in the country. And that's not solely because of Amazon. They've had other tech growth, tech-related growth and job growth, but Amazon is the biggest piece of that. And I mean, that we need to talk about this in Philadelphia. Another story today also pointed out about the deep poverty and aspects of Philadelphia and the fact that, you know, in places in North Philadelphia, hunger has risen 300% in recent years. And you say, well, what does that have to do with Amazon, right? Well, actually, it has a lot to do possibly with Amazon. If you read into the story, the problem is people you know, who have jobs, they're the working poor, they're not getting raises, but their rents have already been rising in Philadelphia, not dramatically, not like Boston or D.C. or New York, but they have been going up. It's been outpacing the income of the working poor in Philadelphia. Yeah. So imagine layering Amazon on top of that. These are people, the woman who was profiled in the article today is a registered nurse. She's not going to be getting a job with Amazon, but she could be seeing her rent going up a couple hundred dollars a month how is the city going to accommodate that? We shouldn't not go after Amazon because of that, but we need to have a real major conversation about that.
Well, Adam, as our economist in this hour, can you bring in those kinds of jobs and also not drive out or make life even more difficult for the, 25% of the city that's poor?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that you could help low-income people by keeping skilled people out of the city is, I mean, it's 100% backwards. Over the last few decades, Philadelphia has seen what happens when you keep out high-skilled people. High-skilled people, high-income people have left the city. They've fled to the suburbs. And that's one of the main reasons why the poverty rate is so high here. Economists understand this. If you look across cities in the U.S., the places that have a more educated population, more skilled people working there, those are better places for low-income people to live. When you have people on Amazon, it's not just that Amazon hires low-skilled people, but you bring high-skilled, high-educated people into the community, and this has all sorts of positive spillovers. It's good for demand. It's good for, you know, stimulating jobs. And, you know, in Will's piece, he mentioned that he doesn't want us to turn into Seattle. But
right.
in terms of mobility, economic mobility, poor people in Seattle, it's one of the best places to be a low-income person in the country. You're more likely to become a high-income person, whereas Philadelphia, economic mobility, we rank really low. So that would be great if you could become Seattle in some ways.
But do you see Amazon as part of that mobility factor, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, you bring in, what you want to avoid is income segregation, where you have all the high income people live in one city and in the suburbs, and all the low income people live in the city. You want high income people in the city. They pay property taxes, they get involved in civic institutions, and they help improve productivity and create jobs. Hmm. So you want high income people in the city. It creates better institutions and a more dynamic economy that benefits everybody.
I know you're not an economist, Will, but you know Philadelphia really well.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, what we're hoping is I don't know if calling it a trickle-down factor is the right word. But yeah, I mean, obviously, if Amazon attracts wage earners, they live in neighborhoods, they'll shop at bodegas, they'll use services, they'll need, you know, house cleaning or whatever, and it can help. But, it just seems to me that if you look at the tech-driven cities in Seattle, is maybe a different kettle. Look at San Francisco, for example. I mean, that is not...
You've got the mega rich, right?
Yeah. And I don't know if Philadelphia would be on that track if Amazon came here, but that is not a city where a poor person could function. And they've had a lot of social issues there. Again, I mean, these things can be worked out, but I don't think that's the way the Amazon dating game, as we're calling it, is playing out. I mean, I think it's all, you know, what can we give to Amazon? And we think we need to think about more than just that.
That's Will Bunch. Again, writes the Attitude column for the Philadelphia Daily News. Also with us is Adam Ozimek. He's a senior economist at Moody's Analytics, and we are talking about the fact that Philadelphia is competing with a lot of cities to be the second headquarters for Amazon. What do you think? 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. I see we've got a couple of people here that want Amazon, Jeff Bezos, to think about Wilmington or Delaware. A tweet from ATP. What about Wilmington area? Parts of DuPont will be available close to the train, airports, low taxes near PA and Maryland colleges. A tweet from Mango. Delaware is perfect for Amazon. Fill the void left by DuPont and AstraZeneca. Favorable tax structure. An email from Ruth. I understand there is a wage tax in Philadelphia. Yes, indeed there is. And some other disadvantages like wanting Amazon to help out with schools and communities. I think that should be a plus. That would make any company a real part of the community, not just a taker and user of resources and people. An email from Phyllis. Unlike Florida, Atlanta, Baltimore, New York City, and other coastal cities, most of Philadelphia will not be underwater as the polar ice caps melt. The impact of climate change should be a major consideration. We live in a complicated world.
Yes.
And to our listeners, you can join our conversation. We want your comments. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Adam, I'm assuming Philadelphia and all these other cities that are competing for Amazon's second headquarters are going to offer inducements and abatements. And does that disadvantage smaller, less well-known companies, maybe even very successful companies that also want to locate in a place, but they're not going to get all those goodies? Is that fair?
I think that it's definitely something to be cautious of, and that's why Philadelphia, you need good cops out there cheerleading for Amazon, and we need the bad cops like Will to say, hey, let's not give away the farm. I think that's a really important message, and it is absolutely possible for places to make the deal too good so that they don't end up benefiting. Because Michigan or Wisconsin just gave subsidies to Foxconn, that $3 billion, it came out to $230,000 per job. So, I mean, when you give away your tax base like that, and you make it, you know, so generous that the city and the state are never going to recoup, or, you know, 30, 40 years it'll take to recoup it, I think that's something that could, you know, crowd out smaller employers and does put some smaller employers at an advantage. So it's got to make sense, the incentives that are offered.
I'm even thinking, I'm not opposed to casinos, but I'm even thinking casinos of a will of casinos and the deal. You can smoke in a casino, for instance, you know, all the deals that were given to get casinos to come to the city or other parts of the state.
Right. And, you know, the most controversial deal in Philadelphia, I think, is the real estate tax abatements that developers get for building certain types of projects in the city. And again, it's one of those things. It's a real conundrum because, you know, I moved to Philadelphia at the start of the 90s, and real estate in this town was dead in the water. And you had to agree that the tax abatement, anything to get the ball rolling. And it did. And now the ball's rolling, and it's rolling. And now you see cranes all over the place. And yet people are still insisting on these abatements. You know, Comcast, not exactly a starving company, got all kinds of inducements to build its headquarters here. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, when we talk about the economics, eventually there's other benefits besides the property taxes they're not paying. And eventually, you know, I guess they do get on the rolls eventually. Right. But, you know, I mean, the schools here have not benefited from Philadelphia's turnaround the way they should. That's not solely because of our tax structure. That's also Harrisburg and other things. But, you know, if you're worried about the finances of the schools, you have to wonder, when are they going to get a break from all this activity?
Well, I wonder too, Adam, even as an investment for any company, don't they want an educated workforce? Isn't it to their benefit to perhaps pick up on what Will has been saying, which is, if you're going to be here, be a good citizen, help the city, but you can also help yourself.
I think if you're trying to figure out whether the abatement program has benefited schools, it's not really accurate to just look at the tax dollars that the abatements have cost without considering what economists call the counterfactual, which is what would have happened without the abatement. And Philadelphia population had been falling for decades. I mean, the city population fell by about 25% compared to 1970. So if the abatement program has been an important factor in turning around the population growth, which I think it has, then you can't just say, well, how would schools look if all those people had moved here and we didn't have the abatements? You have to look at what would happen if we didn't have the abatements. And I think that there's a good chance that the population could have kept falling. And, you know, if there's one thing that's really going to make paying for the city and the schools expensive, pension debts and healthcare costs, and make everything worse, it's a shrinking population. So I wouldn't agree that the abatement program has necessarily not benefited the schools, if you think about how much worse things could have been.
Let me get, looks like Hope calling us from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Hope, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I live in Philadelphia. I absolutely love my city. I disagree strongly with your speaker that you have on, who said that we really can't ask for too much if we're going to do this deal with Amazon. The analogy of the dating game, I think, is really apt. If we didn't ask for what we need and want in this deal, we would be like a bride who's negotiating a bad prenup for herself because she's scared to death that the guy won't marry her. This is a fabulous city. The cost of it for Amazon to come in here because of real estate would be very low. I have this funny feeling that they are going to come here. I read somewhere where this city is the most underutilized retail market in the entire U.S. I also think we have to take the long road. Amazon is not a creative capital company. They're almost parasitical. They're transactional. I'm not sure how much it would add. So that even goes for saying that we need to structure a good deal for ourselves and be really proud of the city. It's a great city, and get what we need. And it's
fair enough.
Protect us. We wait for the next suitor.
Okay, fair enough. We're taking that dating analogy several steps further. Will, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, no, I think Hope made some fantastic points. And, you know, I just want to say about this idea that Amazon only wants the best deal it can get from the cities and it doesn't want to give anything back. I would just offer a quick counterfactual, if you will, to that, which is that if you haven't noticed, the big tech companies, not just Amazon, but also Facebook and Google, are in a period right now where they're getting terrible publicity nationwide for all kinds of reasons. And I don't have time to go into all the reasons now, but these companies are starting to get very concerned about their image and how they're perceived. That's especially important for Amazon because it's a retail company and it depends on the public's goodwill for its business. And that's why I don't think it's out of the realm to go to Jeff Bezos and say, again, with this idea of a partnership, look, this is like the Philadelphia Project. You're coming to a city and you're not only just moving jobs here, you're helping to reinvent the city and make it a better place. And think about
it. And that's good PR, you're saying.
It would be incredible. Think how that would improve Amazon's perception, not just in Philadelphia, but around the country, I think.
Adam, I'm looking at the Sunday Inquirer, three possible sites for Amazon in Philadelphia, one in University City, Market Street between 34th and 39th. They're calling it U City Square. There's the Navy Yard, which is in South Philadelphia. And then there's Schuylkill Yards, which is where the 30th Street train station is. Philadelphia has, for better or for worse, land. I mean, some of it left over from the Industrial Revolution, but this country has this city has land. It has real estate. Does that put it near the front of the pack?
Yeah, I think that's one of the city's biggest advantages, that you can see these spaces. And what's important is it's not only are they big open spaces with lots of room, but they're already sort of in the hopper in terms of being planned for usage. So, you know, it's easy to go to some post-industrial city and say, oh, here's, you know, 100 acres that's sitting here, you know, it's there's a big former manufacturing site on here and you could use this, but you know, the development process is very long. What's good for Philadelphia is because the city's starting a boom, those spots are already kind of moving through development and people are already looking at them and making plans for them, and you know, the city's institutions are sort of gearing up and there's a lot of open space and it's ready to go, which I think is really positions Philadelphia well.
Yeah, I mean, we have brownfields, we have, you know, dilapidated old factories.
There's a lot of sites you could throw out there, but I mean, the Schuylkill Yards is I think especially attractive site because it's right next to the train station, and you know, hopefully Amtrak's working on even faster trains to get us to New York and D.C. from 30th Street, and they'd be right there. I think the city is going to regret, or it should regret, the fact that it's never succeeded in extending the subway out to the Navy Yard, because I think that would have made the Navy Yard an equally attractive thing. I mean, now you don't have that mass transit access, and the traffic on I-95, I think, could be unbearable if you put 40,000 workers there. But
let me read a tweet from, looks like Dina. Are you going to talk at all about zoning? You keep mentioning housing costs without tackling why San Francisco, Seattle have so many issues. I don't know. I don't even know how to answer that particularly. But I mean, zoning is a big issue. It's how real estate decisions are often decided.
Go ahead, Adam. Yeah, Adam.
So both San Francisco and Seattle rank very poorly when you look at the zoning and land use restrictions. It's hard to build there. It's hard to build tall buildings there, and the development process is long and arduous. And Philadelphia ranks much better. So in Philadelphia, it's easier to build new construction, and there's less constraints on it, you know, less strict mandatory parking kind of things. But the other really important thing, in addition to zoning, is just general crowdedness.
Mm-hmm.
So both Seattle and San Francisco, their populations are at historical peaks right now. If you compare them to 30, 40, 50 years ago, they're 25%, 40%, 50% bigger than they used to be. Philadelphia is still 25% below its population peak in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So, you know, and that's why we see this space. That's why there's so much open space. There's still a ton of vacant and undeveloped buildings. And even if we, you know, even without changes to zoning and making it easier to zoning, I think Philadelphia is a long way off from seeing the kind of house price problems that those areas have, just because we've accommodated a lot more people in the city before.
Well, let me ask you, as you said, your concern is that the city will, in a sense, give away all the goodies in order to get Amazon located here. Do you have confidence that the government, the local city government, can negotiate a good deal?
A good deal
for the city.
I think so. I mean, you know, we have a progressive-minded government with Mayor Kenney. I mean, he's been willing to think outside the box with the soda tax. I know some people love it and some people hate it, but the bottom line is we did something here that other than Berkeley, no other city had done. No city of our size certainly had done before, with the idea of funding the schools. And that was an outside-the-box idea to pay for pre-kindergarten in Philadelphia. So is this administration, city administration, capable of thinking outside the box with Amazon? I think they would do better than some of the past administrations we've had here. So I think it'll be interesting. I think Philadelphia will make a good pitch to Amazon. I do. I have some confidence in that.
Let me read an email from Daniel. Why couldn't the headquarters be located in Delaware County? Say the wage tax and business tax issue would disappear. Philadelphia is an area, not just a city. And I guess it should be said, Adam, is that wherever the headquarters is located, it might be in a city, but it will have regional impact, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I mean, people are going to, not everyone who works at Amazon is going to live, right next door to wherever the headquarters is. We know a lot of people commute from the suburbs into Philly and from Philly into the suburbs, and it should have a regional impact. But I think that one of the challenges to doing something like that is, if you look at what Amazon wants, they want to be very close to the population center. They want to be close to the core of the city. So I'm not sure that they would want to be located out in Delaware County, where you've got a little bit more distance to the actual downtown core.
Here's an email from Sharon. She says, did Amazon say when they would make their decision? My understanding, Adam, is that these proposals have to be in sometime in October. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the proposals need to be in early October, and then they'll make their decision, I believe, in 2018.
In 2018. Yeah, so there's a little bit of time. Does it concern you, Adam, that cities are scrambling to get a proposal put together and not having enough time to make a good one?
Well, it's an interesting kind of test, I think. I don't know if this is how Amazon intended it or not. It might be just that they're in a hurry, but this sort of tests the city's ability to pull the various institutions and stakeholders together and sort of move quick and to be reactive to, what the business needs. And I think if a city can get a really good proposal together and get, the public transit agencies, the city, the school district, the developers, the landowners, if they can get all those groups together and to put a really good plan together this quickly, that's a pretty good sign that they've got their ducks in a row. And if they can't, then that's kind of a bad sign. So I'm not sure if they meant it this way, but it's an interesting test for Amazon to put out to these cities.
So, Will, are you comfortable if Philadelphia becomes a city of nerds?
Absolutely. I want Philadelphia to be a city of nerds, but I also want it to be a city of artists and rock musicians. I want the next War on Drugs to come out of here, the rock group, just like the one that already did. And I don't want creative people like that to be priced out of the city. And the other thing I think is even more important is, again, as we talked about earlier, is I don't want, the nurses, the home health care aides, I want the working poor, I want the proverbial the proverbial rising tide that lifts all boats, I think, is what should be the ultimate goal.
We're going to end on that note. Will Bunch, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. He writes the Attitude column for the Philadelphia Daily News. Adam Ozimek, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Senior economist at Moody's Analytics. And you can carry on this conversation. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and see what other people are thinking. Let's see. Al Banks, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, lost my place there for a moment or two. Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Trine Nuri are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you for joining us.